But I do think the presence of the time machine is really the big question here, because if it's the case that we were able to either purchase the time machine outright or purchase a ride on said time machine, then presumably Crash Bandicoot 2 made an extreme amount of money. So
yeah,
I also don't know why they would step out and lead with Crash Bandicoot 2 will take you 5 years. It just seems like a weird, you know, if I was coming back in time, I'd be like,
look, we have a time machine. Butterscotch shenanigans. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 278 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I am awake today.
I'm Sam and I'm also awake and a human being.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is September Twumbly Beef, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show. That's it.
Is Twumbly Beef a profane word? Because it feels like it.
It does feel.
You twumbled beef.
It's on the verge.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's either that or just gross.
Anything could be a swear when said with the right intent.
When I said my name at the top of this podcast, it felt wrong. And for a second, I was like, did I say my own name?
Who am I?
Do you guys have it? Sometimes when you're talking to people, even sometimes when I'm talking to you guys, if I say your name, there's this part of my brain that's like, was that the right one? Every single fucking time.
Yeah. I just don't say people's names almost ever because I don't trust my memory well enough to just know that it'll pull the right name out of the hat, you know?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I just
I don't use names. I just assign people instance IDs.
That's the easiest way to do it. But it's easy to confuse those too, you know?
Yeah, it is. But that's why you got to have a good lookup table. That's why I keep a little notebook in my back pocket.
Yeah. You know? What do you use as the key in this lookup table?
Well, the key is the instance ID, and then a person is just a collection of properties, you know?
So how do you use that to look? So now if you see a person, then now you see the collection of properties. So your lookup table is useless because you can't look up the key with the table.
Well, it's a bidirectional lookup, you know.
Oh, I
so
see.
I know, and I think the hard part is when somebody changes their clothes, you know, because, hey, last time I met this person, they were wearing a red shirt.
Yeah.
And that was one of their lookup properties, right? And the next time I go look them up, I'm like, they're supposed to have a red shirt.
They're gone.
Like, but I don't know. Now they have a blue shirt. Shit's gone crazy. I don't understand. Also, we would like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.beastgosh.net, and we've got a new supporter, Aragul.
That's very spooky.
Who did not leave a message, but is a recurring monthly supporter, so thank you very much.
Thanks.
We appreciate that.
Excellent.
All right, let's talk about life. Let's talk about Sam.
Yeah, let's talk about me. Okay.
Who has a new life rule.
Well, so here's the deal. So, you know, there's this pandemic on. There's a lot of I don't know if you heard a lot of bad shit, right? So one of my coping mechanisms has been, as we discussed in the podcast, with that discovery of the chocolate dipped in peanut butter phenomenon. Okay.
Oh yeah.
So I have since discovering this, been eating chocolate with peanut butter every single day.
Yeah.
Just every single day. Okay.
And is that the rule?
The rule. So here's what I realized is that basically three pieces of chocolate plus like dipping them in peanut butter is essentially a little bit over 10% of probably my entire caloric intake for the day. And I just realized, I was like, I think I want it to be the case for my life as a whole that 10% or more, but not too much more, of my caloric intake ever is chocolate and peanut butter. Yeah. So I'm just deciding.
That also means that 10% of you, given enough time, as you start to place more and more of yourself with the food that you eat for the rest of your life, you just will become 10% peanut butter and chocolate.
And yeah, and I think it's going to be a thing. So
because 70% of you is water. So 10% of the other part.
No. It's still 10% because 70% of chocolate and peanut butter is also water.
Oh my God.
So, you know, it just comes out in the wash.
You know, I feel like too, if you meet somebody and they're like, hello, my name is Sam, and I'm 10% made of chocolate and peanut butter, I'd be like, damn.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's a weird intro.
It's a weird intro, but I'm intrigued and I want to be lifelong friends with this person because I love chocolate and peanut butter.
So Sam, when you say three pieces and dipped in peanut butter, I assume what you mean is three whole chocolate bars, each slathered.
I mean,
in peanut butter.
Absolutely slathered.
I wish I was that egregious in my test. But I think at that point, it'd be like 90%. You know what I mean? That's like a 90% game.
You take two Cadbury dairy milks full-size Cadbury, okay? Mm-hmm. And you got to flip them so that the flat sides are facing each other. You don't want the bumpy sides.
Make a sandwich.
Flat sides, yeah.
Well, to be fair, if you actually use the bumpy sides.
You get more peanut butter in there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. That's true. More surface area. Mm-hmm. More surface area.
Well, actually, it's less about the surface area than it is about the fact that if you make a sandwich with squishy stuff and then you try to eat it, then the squishy stuff shoots out the ass side of the sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've basically stopped eating peanut butter and jelly for
this
reason.
Wait, which side of a sandwich is the ass?
The ass is the side that's not facing you. You eat a sandwich, it's face first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You don't eat a sandwich butt first. That's crazy. How would you do that?
It's actually impossible. Yeah, because whatever side you're eating is its head.
Well, except unless you've already taken a bite, in which case the ass of the sandwich reconfigures right to be the side that you currently bit out of. Because now you have to turn. You know, you're eating a burger. You got to spin it.
That's true. Nobody bites one side of a burger and then immediately turns around and bites the opposite side.
But you do often turn it a little bit. Which I wonder our motivation for that is that we realize the moment we take a bite that now there's a butt looking us straight in the mouth, and we're like, let's just turn this a little bit.
I can't be eating a burger butt first. I'll eat its shoulder. I can handle that.
Even butt adjacent is fine. But you don't
eat its
right
hip.
To the butt.
Yeah, but adjacent is just a thigh. That's that's good. That's tasty meat.
Yeah,
that's
eat fine. That burger thigh.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, this all tracks. Oh, just about
just eat lots of chocolate. I think is
eat lots of chocolate and peanut butter.
Yeah. What kind of chocolate are you eating?
Got some. Just ordered you could buy these packs of the Lindt chocolate bars.
The Lindt.
So it's good.
Is it?
It's
what dark proportion are you?
I think it's like cocoa 76%. It's not. Okay. It's not like turbo dark, but it's dark
it's
enough
dark,
to not just be sugar. Because I want it made to be chocolate. You know.
I think because I think if you're going like the milk chocolate route, I think you do have to minimize how much you're eating. Mm-hmm. You know. But if you're going like a dark chocolate route, because you're basically eating coffee at that point. You know, cocoa and chocolate, like the original physical forms, basically the same thing. There's no nutritional value in either of those. Just a bunch of caffeine and like other things. So the more that you have in your chocolate bar, the more chocolate bars you can eat.
That's true. Yeah,
unfortunately, the more expensive they are. But
now I can't remember if it's actually milk or dark, and I'm concerned that I've been eating too much all of a sudden.
The thing is, you're still alive, then you weren't eating too much.
The thing, I'm doing great. You know, I'm doing fine.
Is that the benchmark?
That's the benchmark.
I'm currently alive, so I can't possibly have been eating too much chocolate and peanut butter.
If you're still alive and you don't feel bad, then you are. Not eating too much chocolate and peanut butter.
I like this rule.
You can eat to the point where you just start to feel sick or dead and then back off a tiny bit. Unless you died, in which case
it's feeling a touch
late.
Dead. You know?
Yeah, just a little dead. And then just back it
too
off.
Far.
Yeah. And this is the only way to find out how much you can eat is just to eat as much as you can and then just evaluate how dead you feel. The mm-hmm. moment you start to feel a little dead, just walk back.
I will There's say, since being trapped indoors for COVID, the amount of times that I've eaten to the point where I feel sick has actually reduced to almost zero. Whereas before,
yeah,
that's
kind of a restaurant thing. Yeah.
Yeah. We got to restaurants. You go, I want to eat the whole plate, you know? I want to take it home, whatever.
I paid $20 for this pile of chips mm-hmm. or whatever. So, I'm going to eat all these chips.
I think I'm not eating as much as I used to, which I think why this whole chocolate peanut butter thing is totally fine. It's fine, you guys. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
The thing is, again, if you feel fine, you don't have to justify.
I just want to be
okay. If you feel fine, you are fine.
You know how occasionally they interview someone who's like 100 and they're like, how did you do it? And they're like, I smoked 3 packs a day and ate 7 bars of chocolate a week. And it's like,
it's always a little bit because it's a daily thing, but it's always a small amount. They're always like, I had a shot of whiskey every day.
Uh huh.
And a glass of wine and one cigarette and one chocolate bar. Like they did every vice. They took each one and then just did a little bit of it, but every day. Every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, you know, the real killer is stress.
That's true. 100%.
And this person was like, I'm just going to treat myself to a nice cold cigarette. Every day, just one, that's my treat.
Well, there is an interesting, because it is true that stress is like incredibly bad for your mm-hmm. body and your health, right? And so there is that interesting push and pull between a thing that reduces stress but is also poison. Versus mm-hmm. the stressor itself. And And in the end, like all these things like have such a slow cumulative and highly variable effect that the answer of whether like is it worse to never have chocolate and be slightly less happy your whole life as a consequence, or have chocolate every day and be slightly more happy? Like nobody is like, I was even looking up, I've been having a cocktail most evenings after work because it's just a nice way to wind down the day. Mm-hmm. I just have one, but then I was like, is one cocktail a day too many? You know, because like we grew up being taught like booze will kill you, cigarettes will kill you, everything will kill you. And of course, cigarettes will kill you, but probably will one a day kill you? Like where's the limit where actually you start to see clinical effects, right?
Mm-hmm. So, where your body can't recover from.
Where your body can't recover and where the fact that you enjoy that as part of your daily routine becomes offset by the fact that routine is putting poison in your body.
Because right? It totally is.
Yeah. So I was Googling around, like looking for studies on it. And to this day, Nobody knows.
It probably varies by person.
That's the problem. Right? Well,
it's so hugely variable. And I think it's one of those interesting things that the diversity of the human health experience is actually so wide that to me, the big takeaway from all of that was basically, unless, because it is universally the case, if you smoke a bunch and drink a bunch, right? Then like those definitely. But the question of like what a bunch means is super, mm-hmm. super unclear. And so, and the studies are all very fuzzy because it's also very hard to study. But, and so either, depending on the studies that you look at, which are both the two like major studies that I could find, were both enormous and actually looked at basically the same data sets. And one said that basically it looks like there's a heart health positive effect of having up to 1 to 2 drinks per day. But like a negative cancer effect, as in like you're more likely to get cancer, but you're less likely to have a heart attack, which is interesting. And then the other study, the other study found the same thing, but they said that the trade off was not worth it, right? Mm, as in like you do protect yourself, but the risk is actually still greater for you in the end of a premature death. But it was by like 15% or something of specifically a premature death, which is actually all causes. Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was looking at that and I was like, in other words, it's probably fine. What's kind of my takeaway?
In other words,
like,
who the hell knows?
Yeah, if we can't see an effect, it's probably fine.
What's really more important though is that you're, one, not overdoing it. And then two, that you're, if you sleep every fucking day, like just sleep effectively and do like a bit of exercise and keep track of your mental health, like keep your stress down. Like those are your three big hitters as far as like how all this stuff will protect
and you know, everything in moderation, you know. But the question of what the hell is moderation is
three pieces of chocolate and some peanut butter a day, man. That's what it is. You know what I'm saying?
So you guys know how people who are total douchebags.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Total,
I'm with you.
Total assholes.
I've heard of a few of those.
They seem to live a really long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they're just always around.
It's probably because they aren't stressed, because they're the things causing everybody else stress.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, they may actually be stressed, but they're just suppressing everybody else's life expectancy even more by creating a lot more stress around themselves. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Well, it's actually true, because the amount of stress that you create for yourself in total is just like your – and of course, if you're an asshole, you're usually really self-absorbed, so probably your only stresses are your self-induced ones, because you just don't give a shit about everybody else, right? But if you are a person who isn't an asshole, then everybody who is, all of them, cause
you still got your normal baseline stress. Yeah. Other people are dumping stress onto you. So then the people who end up living to be like 100, 110, 120, they just don't give a fuck.
Right.
Yep.
Like they're not on either side of this equation. They're not an asshole and they're not surrounded by assholes. They're just hanging out, eating a pound of chocolate a day, mm-hmm. not giving a fuck.
That's where I want to be.
That's where I want to be. All right, let's talk about studio news. Specifically, we are living in the midst of a waking nightmare called search engine optimization. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, what is a nightmare of my own making? And I still think this is interesting at a high technical level, so I'm going to try to talk about it without getting
into it. Don't touch that dial. Okay, we're going to
go deep, but I still think it's
interesting. This is search engine optimization explained like I'm 7 edition.
Yes, or maybe like 15, because I think our listeners like are 15. Not 7, I don't think, on average, but who knows?
Listen, you fucking 7-year-old.
Learn about SEO, you asshole. All right, so SEO
really got unexplainably aggressive.
Yeah, we're feeling very saucy today. You know,
very saucy morning.
Let's go.
And, And children, you're not assholes probably, so I apologize for
Some of them might be.
A little bit.
Search engine optimization. This is the question of, I got a website. It's on the internet. How, when somebody types in a search request into Google or Bing, I guess, that's a thing that people use.
Sure.
How does my question, the words I poked into that box, how does that cause Google or whatever to come up and say, oh, here, this is that website you made, like this person over here, that's the thing that gets shown. Because, of course, there's 100 quadrillion websites or something. And so how do you convert if you go searching for I want to buy some pants. And so you say buy pants or whatever into your search bar, right? How does Google know what to serve you? So this is what search engine optimization is basically everybody playing these tricks, trying to figure out what does the search engine do so that I can make my website be the thing that sells you the pants?
Because everybody knows that once you go past once you go past the three top things, no one gives a shit. So if you're not there, you're nowhere, right?
And the sole reason that Google is the second most valuable company on the planet or whatever, and far ahead of almost all governments also, is because of how good of a job they did at serving you the right pants website. Right. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing. And they're selling you ads on top of it. So how you get that to happen is now this mostly black box
with your own website.
With your own website. Yeah. So now you've got a website and you're trying to appear in your listing, right? So there's now this sort of dark magic process where nobody really knows how things work, and Google won't tell you, but they'll just hint at things that they'll say things like, oh, these things are definitely important, but they won't say, what does that mean? How exactly do you do it? How important is it? And of course, it's all changing over time because Google at the same time is trying to prevent all those assholes out there who are selling you fake pants from showing up at the top of the listing, right? They don't care, of course, if they're serving you up conspiracy websites.
I assume pants that only cover the front half of your legs and are just completely open in the back.
Those are chaps, I think. So those are still real pants. So that's still fine. More like you go to buy pants, and what you get in the mail instead is a sheet of paper that has the word pants on it.
Or it's like those ones where people buy something off eBay for $2,000. I saw what was someone bought they're buying a new Mac off eBay for $2,000, and then the thing that they got was what was in the picture, but it was actually this big. It was it was a couple inches wide. So they had basically made a tiny little fake laptop sold it as if it was real. So that sort of shit, right? That's what you're dealing with.
Yep, exactly. So now your goal, you make a website and you're like, okay, I want to make it so that when people type in the thing that is important to me, let's say you make video games and you're like, I want it to be the case that when somebody types in super fun crafting game into Google, that Crashlands comes up, right? Like that's your goal. So that's the end goal of SEO. The reality of you being able to get there depends on how many competitors you have, how much you guess correctly about how the search engines work, et cetera, how much time you invest into building your site to then match all those things. So now if we turn back our own clock 3 years ago, whenever I first put up our new website, I had made a few assumptions about how things worked, which I discovered 2 weeks ago were – one in particular was very incorrect to the point where we basically have I'm not sure what the scoring is for SEO, but if there's a zero, then that's basically what.
the one saving grace in this, of course, is that our games are on these different storefronts that have excellent SEO.
Doesn't really matter, probably, but it also might. And so I should have known this because there have been various points over the past couple of years. Where I have been like, ooh, what was that blog post we wrote about, whatever, right? Because I wanted to use it as a reference for something. And then because our own website doesn't have a search function for our blog, I can't get to it there, right? And so, but the reason I didn't ever put one in there was because I was like, I don't need to add a search to our own website because that's what Google is for. Google exists. So then I would search Google using Butterscotch Shenanigans, which is very SEO optimized because nothing else has that combination of words in it. And then, some snippets from the title of the article that I could remember, and I remembered accurately, and just nothing came up, just nothing, right? So I should have, when that happened, noticed that this shouldn't be possible. This should not be possible, right? And for some reason, just didn't quite register.
Well, we had some other things going on.
We had other stuff going on, to be fair. And again, it just doesn't matter that much, probably. So, but more recently, we've been, because like we talked about the last episode, I've been wanting to write more stuff about the technical things that we're doing on the website and And we've been talking about more blog posts that we want to put together and, you know, share with different outlets and stuff, but also host on our own website. And the idea that we would make one of those and put all the time into it and then just, it's just gone.
Have it be completely unfindable.
Yeah, it's just not findable, is a huge bummer. And then, of course, now we're working on Crashlands 2. And so people aren't going to be covering it that much, but we'll probably start writing blog posts about it soon.
Yeah, so people search for Crashlands 2 and
just find our own
posts about it don't show up.
Yeah, it's really bad. So I finally decided I had to go fix this, and I've been now for the past – really actually the past few days in terms of like full-time work, getting it squared away. And I thought – like I knew what I had to do, and I won't go into the details of what I had to do, but I knew what I had to do. And so I was like, okay, I'll just go take care of this. I'll be fine.
And then
there was like this cascading series of complications and then also traps that my past self had laid for me that made it so hard to actually do. And it's just been – it's been remarkable going back because this was code that – because I knew SEO was important. And so I had done what I thought it was like necessary to make it happen.
You were actually purposefully solving this problem 2 years.
Yeah, like two years ago. Yeah. But I just did it in like – because I didn't really understand at the time what was actually happening clearly. But as importantly, I also was a much, much worse programmer. And so because I was like – I had basically been doing Node, the language that we use on our server side stuff for like 3 months at that point, mm-hmm. right? And so I barely knew the language I was using. I didn't really understand the problem. And so I just came up with something. And badly programmed it. And the thing that I came up with was absurd because there was a problem at the time, which is for every page that you have, you still you have to do something. You have to do something so that when that page gets served up to Google specifically, that Google's like, ooh, I can read this. I know it's here. I can process this and do stuff to it, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that I had gone about – because I was like, oh, the problem here is that we're making tons of content all the time, right? And so it's – and a lot of it's dynamic because we make a blog post – then the server doesn't know about that before the blog post is made because it doesn't exist yet. So my solution to this, and also things like we have a whole bunch of help pages and we add some more every once in a while and so on. And some of those things are made only on the code that gets delivered to you. So the server actually doesn't know about it, right? So my solution was like, okay, so if the server doesn't know about it necessarily, then instead of me just being like, maybe I'll just tell the server about it. Like I'll just like find a way to have those things line mm-hmm. up, right? I was like, I know what I'll do.
Anytime
an administrator, like one of us on the team, right, is browsing, then every time we hit a page, the page itself will collect its own information and send that to the server and be like, hey, make sure you know about me, that I exist.
Right, because you know how common we as administrators just casually stroll through random pages just on the browsing website. Just browse our own website. You know how we do that as a hobby.
Right? It's that would mean that if and of course, this is, you know, I guess, of course, it's not the right way to say that. We also have three different deployments of the website. We've got the dev server, which only we see. It has its own database, its own data, right? And then we have beta and production. We spend most of our time on the dev server. So if we're perusing stuff on the dev server, that mm-hmm. doesn't inform the other one that those things right. exist.
It's a totally different set of data.
Yeah. So what we end up with in the end is basically we're completely unaware, actually, then. Of what pages on our own website are actually being tracked that the server knows exist and that when Google asks for those things, it actually can even give it any information at all.
Our website's more or less invisible. It's
basically invisible. And I knew that there were some things that were not optimal. I've known this the whole time, but I didn't realize just how bad it was because there was a key assumption that I was making, which I think I'll just say because I think it's not too in the weeds, which is that when Google fetches a page – that page is going to have some JavaScript in it probably, right? And the thing that I had read and I knew was true was that Google runs the JavaScript when it downloads the page, okay. right? So if that's true, then if the page's content itself is created by that JavaScript, then I was like, well, then
Google has
stuff will get created. Google has it. And so now mm-hmm. it's all going to be there. That's fine. So that's all true, except if what that JavaScript is doing is downloading data to display. Because Google doesn't wait. It doesn't wait for stuff to come in. It runs whatever's already there.
Yeah.
So if you have JavaScript that's plugged into your site, like that'll run. If that re-renders a page and changes stuff, that'll all happen. Google gets that. But if you then say like, ooh, I need to go get this piece of data, say a blog post or and over time, I've moved more and more and more of the data on the website into the server.
Right.
You've made the
website more invisible over the last couple of times.
And so, so I think the reason that we were able to get away with it was because – at the beginning, most stuff was created on the site itself in synchronously so that Google could just create it and it was fine. And over time, that's become less and less true. Mm. And so, and it all came to a head when I read a line somewhere because I was doing some research for my own personal projects. And I saw a line somewhere that somebody mentioned that Google doesn't wait for stuff to come back. And I was like, wait, fuck. And so I went, Google has they have a panel. If you own a domain, you can set up which is actually a nice tip. I can't remember what it's called, but if you just look up like Google Search Console, you'll find it. But you can actually like register your domain and then it'll show you like, here's what Google sees when I visit this page and here's all the list of errors and so on. And so I went and I loaded it up and I told it to render the front page for me so I could see like, what does Google see? And it's just a fucking white document. There's nothing in it. And I was like, oh no. So I was like, look at the HTML that it sees. And it's just the template page the server sends before anything else happens. And that was it. And so
horrified.
Fuck.
So what I'm imagining is like it's a scene in a movie. Adam, the tech savvy hacker guy with like a cool mohawk or something, because you know, hacker. Mm-hmm. Sits down at his computer, he's got his cup of coffee, he's blasting some German techno music, getting ready to do his programming. He's pulling up different documents, looking at like how does Google do shit, whatever, and all of a sudden the music stops and he zooms in on this one line.
And then you see the coffee cup hit the ground.
And he's just like, oh, no, 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 no.
Honestly, it's about right. I mean, I think that we've had this actually. We've been working on the CrashLands 2 art and getting that stuff figured out. And there's an interesting parallel here because so I've been pushing really hard on this idea of that I sort of picked up on as well in a similar sort of fashion of saying, oh, shit, from all of these art videos and this art tutorials and stuff I've been doing. Of this idea that in art, your values are more important than your colors. And so value is just the relative amount
of brightness,
basically. How dark or how light a thing is. And the reason that that's important is because that's what allows you to actually make out different shapes, actually. And so an image with good value contrast it just looks better than one that does not and allows for higher readability. So importantly, as I've been starting a work on these sort of these pre-production tiles and backgrounds and stuff for the game. My entire theory about this, kind of like what I was talking about, has been with this sort of, you know, I know how this works. Like values are super important. And so what I did, because I'm clever, was sort of graded out where the content was going to sit. So players and creatures and stuff like that have a higher total value range than things like the terrain, blah, blah, blah. And what ended up happening though, because of this, was that this first round of art that we got in, the ground looked the same.
Like an incomprehensible darkish blob.
Mm-hmm.
As you purplish blue. Because it wasn't important, so you put it all on the lower end of the value spectrum.
And so I wasn't making a cool picture out of the ground, which, by the way, is most of the screen at all times, right? And so and I think this has actually been the issue I've had with environment stuff the whole time. I haven't ever been able to quite grapple it.
And yeah, because it's a sameness. Right. But in a way that's really hard to understand as being a sameness, right? It's sort of like we talked in the past about procedural generation, right? Where everything is different. Like every scene you see is different, but in a way that actually looks the same. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. And so it's the same sort of thing where it's like you take this little bit of knowledge you have and you're like, okay, yeah, I know how this works.
Yeah. You make a few assumptions.
Yep. Yeah. And then you go to see if it passes muster and of course it fails. The benefit, of course, on the art side is that people can look at it and be like, something's not really feeling good about this. Mm-hmm. On the coding side or writing, like a lot of the other programming or other domains of these disciplines are completely opaque. Like you said, it'd be a little harder
to spot.
Yeah. How hard would it be to figure out if the SEO is working if you didn't know the tools?
You have to know what tools to use to discover it or know like what things you should be looking at. And then, of course, one of the core problems with testing is it regression? Is that the word I'm looking for? It's a reversion, whichever one it is. But it's when a thing works now, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't have a proper test for it. And over time, because you've changed things over here, changed stuff over there, the world around you has changed. So like Google changes how it does SEO, for example. So things are changing around you. And so even though that thing worked when you made it, it doesn't necessarily work now. And if you don't have a system in place that will alert you the moment that thing stops working, then you're toast.
That's very interesting, Adam.
Good stuff.
Was it? So just on the off chance that was a really bad transition and everyone's confused, my internet did go out. I finished a thought, but nobody can remember what that thought was. So it's probably fine.
Yeah, but it was very interesting. It was. And I'm going to hear about it when I re-listen to the episode you know, later. Yeah. So I also want to, before we get on to questions, just want to hit on the IndieLand event.
Oh, yeah. Happened. Yeah. So
let's talk about that.
Last Sunday, Levelhead was the kickoff game for the IndieLand event, which we'd sent to Ballyhoo out about. And it was a ton of fun. So what that event was is we talked about it on the podcast previously, but it's this charity event run by The Completionist that goes raises money for dementia research. And during our time on stream, I think they ended up raising like $2,500 or something like that. Pretty awesome. But what was very fun about it was it was both The Completionist and Grant Poobear. And Grant Poobear is both these guys are actually really incredibly talented platforming gamers, essentially. And Grant Poobear in particular is a speedrunner or a Kaizo playing Mario Maker like influencer. And what a Kaizo is, for people who aren't familiar with this term, is essentially just hard as fuck. Is you put that in there. Like, that's what it is. Hard as fuck platforming levels.
Well, yeah, it often requires a very specific series of incredibly high speed movements
and perfectly timed events
that are perfectly timed.
If you miss one thing up, you're just dead. Or even if you're not, you've permanently broken your ability to win later on.
Yeah,
at some point.
Yeah. And so it was really fun to see both of these guys take this thing on, because the first hour was actually Grant Poobear playing through levels. And the first level we hit him with was made by Flow Art, who's one of our excellent creators in the community. And it's just a Kaizo level, and which is hilarious, because as far as like choosing where to start on these playlists, like we had given him 30 levels and I think they had downloaded them, I think, before we like reordered them. And yeah. So they just they already had them in sort of what was this sort of like our just kind of collected order at first. And so I saw this level pop up and I was like, oh, God. Like, oh, shit.
Because it has a 0.4% clear rate or something like that.
And he just did it. Fucking did it. And it was amazing. So fun to watch.
And it was also his first time playing Levelhead.
Yeah. It was his first 15 minutes. He booted up and like played through like 5 minutes of the tutorial stuff. So the guy's got such built-in just, you know, essentially platforming skill. There was tons of fun to watch him run through levels. And then him and The Completionist did co-op levels for the last hour, which was hysterical, especially they ended on this level that Specchio had made. I believe this was ages ago. It was one of the earliest two-player co-op levels that we had. And amounted to, I think they ended up spending like 25 minutes just on the last section of this thing, which involves, in a teamwork fashion, you and your partner are basically in two separate tunnels that are connected by these holes in the floor that are, of course, covered with spikes. And so you could throw things between the tunnels through these spike floors. And so you have to be passing objects back and forth constantly while avoiding spikes and all sorts of other stuff. And watching them work their way through that was absolutely hysterical. And they had some really absolutely wonderful things to say about the game. It was just a blast to see. And I will say one of the nicest things I think I've ever heard someone say about our designs came from two of them. Were about halfway through, you know, we told them about how the marketing department works and how we really try to solve a lot of these problems that are present in games like Mario Maker. And there was just this pause, and then they were like, thank you. And I was like, for what? They're like, it sounds like you literally thought about every single thing about this and made it really good. And we were like,
that was the goal.
That was the goal, yeah. But honestly, like, it's weird because you, like, Levelhead still has like a 97% rating on Steam, right? So like, it's not, I know that the game is really good, but it's a different thing to hear it in particular terms from people who are,
whose job is to play games.
Exactly. And exactly.
What's good and so on.
Well, it reminds me of when we got the game of the year from Touch Arcade.
Yeah.
And that sort of like hit me on an emotional level, because all these guys do is play games and review them.
And like a dozen a week or something like that, or more even.
Yeah, more.
Each, you know. So these folks go through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games over the course of a year. And then at the end of the year to pick ours out and be like, this is the one, you know.
Especially for us, because Crashlands came out in January, right? So they had to remember that Crashlands had to stay top of mind for an entire year. And if you like think back to the games that you've played, like
what did you play in January?
Yeah, those actually are so hard to pick out, really, right? Because you'll have – and actually, really what it is exercise in having the same experience, right? Where if you think back, like, what's the last game you remember playing, right? It isn't even necessarily the last game you played. It may be something you played 3 years ago or whatever, mm-hmm. right? But, like, if you just think the first game that comes to your mind, right, which is basically what Crashlands was in that context. So that was very spectacular.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's good – yeah, it's good to hear positive things from people whose life – is very deeply connected to this kind of a game or just games in general. And this very kind of like unbiased, just like, yeah,
it's this just
is
good.
This is just really good. Yeah. So that was super great to see. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest voted question comes from a street sign.
Does it just say stop?
No, it's a bit longer than that. So I'm not sure how big this sign is. It might be one of those ones like a scrolling,
marquee
LCD thing. Why is Roid Rage so dang difficult compared to the other titles? What are your own personal high scores in it? And most importantly, does juice naturally occur in space or did a juice tanker spill it in transit? So this just kind of comes back to our conversation we had quite a while ago about how you may as well not have a store description in your game. Mm-hmm. Because the description of Roid Rage in the store is actually just answers these questions. That it was, in fact, a juice tanker.
Yeah,
good guess. Spilled its juice in an asteroid field. They've got an infinite supply of unpaid interns and cheap spaceships that explode at the slightest touch to go out and retrieve all this juice that got spilled. That's the canon. Mm-hmm. Lore.
And the reason it's so hard is because there's two ways to make games last a long time. Right. So one is to put a lot of content in there. The other is to make it super fucking hard.
You may not have noticed we didn't do the first one.
Yeah.
With Roid Rage.
Yeah, the only content in there is your spaceship, asteroids, and juice.
Yeah.
So that's it.
You know,
That's it.
The fact that you can play that game for like 8 hours, which is actually how long quite a few people do you end up playing. Same thing with Flop Rocket. Like, there's not a lot in there.
Just, it's about how long it took us to make the game. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It tracks.
It's because it's hard. Mm-hmm. So it is hard because it had to be for you to find it worth playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Roid Rage is kind of like – it's one of these weird things where we made it just because we were like, what can we get away with? What's like the smallest, simplest possible thing we could make? And it's just like, yep, you have two buttons, left, right. The ship goes on its own and there's good stuff and bad stuff. These are this is like Flappy Bird level of game mechanics where there's a thing you can do, which is turn, one goal, which is to get the good thing, and one obstacle, which is don't hit the bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it still works. So it was just one of those fun experiments. I think it actually is oddly somewhat unique. There aren't really other games that are like it out there for some reason. So, you know, that's kind of nice. Mm-hmm. But anyways, next question comes from Chalosis, who says, a time machine explodes into Seth's backyard. Mm. The hatch opens and the three of you step out, grizzled, red-eyed, a few more gray hairs, and say, Crashlands 2 will take you 5 years. What do you do?
I ask them what the stock market looks like. I verify that I'm not going to die for 5 years, which is... At least I didn't, I guess, in that timeline. I'm not sure how time works in this
conference. The three of us stepped up. Sam's got
timeline into our timeline. Right.
Sam's got a new belly from all the peanut butter and chocolate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just Sam's feet are now chocolate.
Yeah, because he's 10% chocolate.
It fills up from the bottom, you know, up. So I'm 10% chocolate. My feet are melting rapidly because of the global warming situation.
Which is a big problem for chocolate people.
Actually, I assume we sit on the spaceship and we're like, oh, God, it's chilly here.
Yeah.
So cold. They said during a record-breaking heat wave.
I think we would just be more grizzled and red-eyed from getting older. Is that correct? It seems just – I guess it almost seems like it has nothing to do with making another game. Just like
– Well, I mean that will happen, but it might be exacerbated by the game potentially.
Mm. Yeah. So if they said, you know, Crashlands 2 will take you 5 years, I would probably say – yeah. Yep. I would probably say
–
Yeah, that tracks.
I would probably say so that means our financial situation lasted for 5 years?
Yeah.
That's great.
Without releasing a game? That's pretty good.
I would just ask them, like, was it worth it? Because if it's worth it, then who gives a shit? It's fine.
They may not know. It may be like on launch day. Maybe what
after
maybe
all that work, then on launch day, suddenly they get sucked into a time hole.
Mm. Well, it specifically says a time machine. So what the implication here sucked is that Crashins 2, Crashins 2 took the normal amount of time, you know, a couple of years. And then the other 3 years were spent building the time machine.
To go back.
To go back.
Right.
To troll past
us. Or did we buy the time machine? Did we...
That's true. Did
we spend 2 years making Crashlands and then find a publisher who was like, I want this. And they gave us a fuckload of money. And then we were like, nope, this timeline's fucked. We're going to take this fuckload of money. Mm-hmm. We're going to go buy this time machine, go back in time, and then warn our past selves off of Crashlands by trying to scare them about how long it will take so that they go down a different path where they instead do...
As I say, it sounds pretty ideal to end up in a position where there's just, you know, boatloads of cash and you made the game after a couple of years. So I do think the presence of the time machine is really the big question here. Because if it's the case that we were able to either purchase the time machine outright or purchase a ride on said time machine, then presumably Crashlands 2 made an extreme amount of money. So
yeah,
I also don't know why they would step out and lead with Crashlands 2 will take you 5 years. It just seems like a weird, you know, if I was coming back in time, I'd be like, holy shit.
Look, we have a time machine.
You know?
Hey, guys.
But this also implies that by this point, time machine travel has become so normalized that we're not even fazed by it, you know?
Maybe we've been back multiple times at this point.
Yeah. And if this is the first thing that we say, we also assume that this wouldn't be surprising to our past selves, which means our past selves have also seen a whole bunch of time machine travel at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So apparently then in this new universe that has been constructed here, the people in the current time for some reason can't like go forward so that, you know, right? So otherwise like this would be even less interesting, right? But people can come back and I guess then go back to the future again, you know, I don't know, maybe. Mm-hmm. But people in the present can't go to the future for some reason.
It's against the rules, you know.
Against the rules for some reason. And so we probably at this point would be just really tired of seeing our future selves coming back and telling us random facts.
Yeah, but like, is that all? How about a you know, qualitative assessment of it? Did it do well? Yeah. How are we doing? Tell me the stocks. Just give me lottery numbers.
Yeah, that's one of the rules of time travel is you can't express opinions about things, you know?
Yeah. Actually, why did all three of us come back? Like, what was our – because we only need one person to go back to to send a message, right? But if we sent three people back, that implies we're trying to move back to the past. You know,
mm-hmm. Well, there's we're doing that
alongside our other three selves.
Also, I'm going to be honest, I would never come back to 2020. Just going to throw that.
Yeah. Well, because the implication here is that every subsequent year after 2020 is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we would come back to 2020
is a horrifying. It's a bad sign. It's
bad. Because if we were trying to do something that made any sense at all, we would go back to about 2010 mm-hmm. with all of the skills that we had developed, right? And we would start making games all over again, but now with all of those skills and knowledge so that we could be at the front of the indie wave instead of on the back-ass part of it, which has been a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I'm pretty confident that most of the folks who did succeed at that time were time travelers. So we would just be joining the ranks.
Yeah, so I would mostly be confused about the implications of this time travel scenario. Why all three of us? Why to this point in time?
Yeah, because you could have told us this literally at any point in the past, technically.
And really, they should have come back to 2016 or 17, whatever it was, mm-hmm. right before the Bitcoin bubble happened. Actually, no, even better than that. They should have come back to like 2005 when Bitcoin was invented and was trading for like a cent or whatever.
Yeah, they'd be like, just buy all of them.
Just buy fucking all of it. Because and then in 18 or whatever year, whatever that was that happened, it will be worth $20,000 for the briefest, for like a day. Right. Mm-hmm. Or like a 6 hour span or whatever. Sell all of it in that moment. And
which is pretty wild that if you spent like $10 on Bitcoin in 2009, then you'd like,
you're just like a billionaire. There's a story of a guy who bought like, I don't know, like $100 worth in like 2005, like when it first came out, basically. Right.
Yeah.
When it was worth nothing. And then just had it on a hard drive. Right. And then he couldn't figure out – he like couldn't get back into it
because
he like lost the drive or like it was encrypted or something happened. He couldn't get back into it.
He knew that he had like $15 million.
Yeah, he just had like infinite money just living on this drive and he couldn't get it. And I was like, that's even worse than missing the window, you know?
That's cruel.
Being that close.
That is brutal.
Yeah, and then of course the thing – I mean it's still – there's still worth several thousand dollars now, so yeah, he's still in good shape, presumably, if he got
it. If he ever gets it off of there, yeah.
But I agree. The implication of a time traveler coming back to 2020 is a really bad sign.
Yep, already very suspicious.
About what's coming down the
– So I think, yeah, road. I think the only appropriate response for us would be to say, well
– Well, fuck.
Well, fuck. let's go start a new business where we create bunkers?
We need
to find out more information about just what hellhole we have landed in, because
– That's what we need to
get. There's so many bad things happening at once. The question is, which one of the things is the thing that makes it so much worse over the next 5 years?
Or is it just all of them, you know, kind is of in concert? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from Butterscotch Atheist, who says, food stories. What are your favorite meals to cook? What was the most ambitious culinary project you've put your mind to? Favorite foods? Least favorite foods?
Mm-hmm. I like all foods. But the I used to like food that was basically fairly non- flavored, I guess, because we grew up, you know, Midwestern style cooking, which is it's mostly salt about fat.
That's bland.
It's about fat and sweet. That's its two kinds of parts of the flavor profile. And meat. But the meat also just has, you just put more fat on the meat.
Than put butter on has. It.
You just put butter, you know, whatever. So I grew up with that and then was introduced to more more elaborate taste profiles in college in particular. And then after that with my wife. And so now, like, I just – anything I can try, I'm going to try that thing. The more things it lights up inside of my face, the more into it I am. And so at this point, my favorite foods are mostly Chinese and specifically Sichuan things because they have a lot going on. But then also Indian because it's got so much going on. And now I just can't make things without just putting, like, 10 different spices on it. You know, because I just want, like – I need tons and tons of flavor. That would be interesting. So yeah. So for me, it's like I'll just eat whatever and be happy about it. But the more it's got going on,
what about your culinary endeavors? What's your I think you guys have also made ridiculous cocktails and stuff too. But like, what's your most sort of intensive thing that you've made?
The most intensive food item I've ever made was 1,000 years ago when I made a companion cube cake.
Oh yeah.
Which was in 2008.
Wait, do you remember that turducken you made for my 18th birthday?
Oh yeah, the turducken. That was probably like, in terms of a real food item, that was probably most. I spent like 4 hours deboning the 3 different birds required to make a turducken and then brined them overnight. It was in the winter, so I just like made a brine and put them out just like in a snowbank in the pot, you know, so they could just sit there because we couldn't fit it in the freezer or the fridge, I mean, and then cooked it the next day. That was good shit.
That was real good.
It was good.
I think that's fair. That's probably my most intensive project that I have done. I just don't cook really. It's not a thing that I enjoy. And I don't know why, because it's a kind of thing that it seems like on paper I'd be into, because it's like doing science experiments and then you get to eat something delicious when you're done or terrible, depending on how the experiment goes.
I think it's a problem of marginal returns, right? Because like you can spend 20 minutes cooking something and make it super, super tasty and great. Or you can spend 3 hours cooking something and having it be a bit more tasty than that. But there are
some things that take 3 hours that are then like infinitely better. But most things that take 10 times longer to make are just like the same or a little bit better or whatever, right? Than something you could make in, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes. So I think that's fair. The only culinary thing that just like in my daily practice or like frequent practice that I really care about is actually popcorn.
Stove-side popcorn.
Never-ending goal of like trying to make the best fucking popcorn possible. So the tricks for those, for making the best popcorn is and Sam and his wife have their own approach also. So we haven't had a popcorn off yet and we won't be able to until the end of COVID, but like I'm getting those skills up.
Good, because you're gonna get crushed, buddy. Yeah.
So I'll be the judge.
So my strategy is you need 2 to 3 fats for your oil. They gotta be really good, interesting ones. So and also coconut oil is the base because that's also what movie popcorn uses, like movie popcorn butter, you know? And so like that's your base is that stuff. And then I use ghee as my second fat. Because ghee is like kind of cheesy, you know, it's a clarified butter, right? But it's like a little cheesy, so there's just like a little bit more interesting stuff going on. And then my third one is just like something interesting I'll throw in. So what I've been doing is I've discovered that recently you can now find like specific animal fats in lots of grocery stores where it's just like here's duck fat and here's beef fat and here's whatever, right? And so like I'll just go pick one and then use that one until it runs out. So currently I'm on beef fat, which is not the best one. Duck was fucking stellar. So that's what I'll probably go back to. And so then you use a lot of it. So there should be a nice, like a nice little layer of fat in the bottom of your pan, mm-hmm. right? That's like, it should be just about as tall as a popcorn kernel, but then all the way across.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then that's for your cooking part. There's a whole strategy for how you cook it and get all the kernels, all that kind of stuff. But we'll skip that. And then when you flavor it afterwards, then so you get it dumped out immediately, and you leave the lid on at a tilt so that all the moisture is shooting out and escaping, so it's nice and crunchy, right? Get it out, dump it in your bowls, and then take nutritional yeast, which is also cheesy and like it's got a kind of umami cheesy thing going on. The first time we did it, where I was like, I don't know about this, and then like it grew on me instantly, like within like 5 minutes of going through that mm-hmm. first bowl. And now I can't do popcorn without it. Liberal, just fucking hose it down. and then of course, like, you know, a nice splash of salt, and then just like go for wild flavor profile. So I found that if you take a chili powder and you throw it in the pot, like after all the seeds are in there and it's hot, but not hasn't started popping yet. If you put that in on top, then you don't get the inhalation toxicity like while you're eating it, where it's just like killing you, right? But you still get the spicy tingle. And then the taste is even a little bit better because it's cooked a little bit more, you know? And then after that, you just like top whatever flavors you want. You just like fucking, your popcorn when you're done should be like, look like a Christmas tree.
It has ascended.
Right? There's so much stuff going on.
So yeah, my method is a little bit different.
Hold on. Okay. So we talked about starting up this alternative B-Scotch dev, you know, website.
Yep.
Can we also get a YouTube channel where just Adam experiments with popcorn, just like
popcorn and cocktails.
At first, when you were like, well, you know, I'm really into popcorn, and I was like, what?
How can you be into popcorn?
You throw it in the pot and you pop it.
No, man, you gotta try.
But
it's like having a cocktail and the most delicious popcorn in the universe, like to end most of your days. It's just so good. Yeah. Brown. I used to go with a lot of browned butter as part of my strategy for making it, but it's so hard to get that right without it getting burnt and stuff because I just go with my other oils.
Yeah. My method is considerably more relaxed. You just put some olive oil in there, throw some kernels in there, and then once it's done popping, you just dump a bunch of seasoning into the pot, shake it up, and then you're done. But the seasoning is kernel seasonings, white cheddar stuff, which is delicious.
Yeah, I'm using mostly Penzi's, fancy Penzi's spice. Like, I'm just like, everything is, if I could take it to a max
level. I was going to say, this is like the most maximum popcorn I've ever heard of.
Oh, yeah, it's so good. It's so good. Like, every night we have it, Jenny's like, and Jenny, so my wife can like, she can cook anything and do it a stellar job. But even the first time on almost everything she's made, like, it already came out better than the things that I had at restaurants of that same type, you know? And she like loves cooking. She's just really into it. She's like a million cookbooks, knows everything. And this is the one thing that every time I make it, she's like, God, this is so good. And where she won't even make it anymore because she's like,
why bother?
Yeah. Why bother? Like you're going to, in the same way that like, there's nothing that I'll make that Jenny could also make. so my specialization, I'm in like, cause it is my one thing, right? So I'm like specializing fucking hard
into popcorn. Into popcorn.
Yeah, that's so good.
It's excellent.
And that's good. That's good. Cause it's a versatile food, you know?
Yeah.
It's good for movie nights, good for chilling, good for snacking.
You can make it sweet, you can make it savory. I used to really like the sweet version, but there's less room to play with sweet versus savory. You can just like, put everything you can imagine in the same thing and it just keeps getting better every time.
Yeah. All right, so we have time. We have a bit of time for one final, fairly quick question from Irish Luck, who says, is it better to work outside your comfort zone with a high risk of failure, a higher chance of learning, or work inside your comfort zone with a lower chance of failure, but less learning?
Depends on what you're needing to do.
This is really all about, because I would say it's always better to learn as much as you can. But we were having a conversation about woodworking earlier this week, and about how like if you're programming, you can experiment a lot. Because if you mess something up, you just get a little line in your debug log and it's like, hey, you fucked up line 17. You're like, oh, and you just go fix it. The end. Mm-hmm. If you are trying to learn how to like build a cabinet and you've never worked with wood before, get ready to go through tons and tons of boards and planks and screws and whatever else.
It's very expensive. Your startup costs are expensive. Your resources are expensive. When you fuck it up, it's expensive. And it's not just expensive in resource costs, but also time. If it takes you, an hour to perfectly measure and then cut a thing, and then it turns out you were off by something, or then you did it, you painted it and you were all ready to go, and then you went to mount it and realized you put the fucking hinge in the wrong spot or something. Yeah. Like, it's like, now you just take all that work and you go back and you redo all of it.
Yeah. And so here's the thing. If you are trying to sell your house and you're like, fuck, I need cabinets because I don't have any for some reason. I got to get these cabinets put up. Now's not the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to get that house sold. You're on a deadline. You've got goals. But if you are fine with your existing cabinets and you're like, I just want to see if I can make better ones. And it's just something that's going to take me some time. And it's okay that it's going to take some time because I'm not going to, lose anything horrible if I mess these cabinets up. Mm-hmm. Right. Then you can take the time. So it's really just about it's about risk, I think, in the sense of what is actually the cost. Like, what do you actually have to lose by taking the time to learn this?
Yeah, because right? Staying inside your comfort zone doesn't come without risk or additional cost, because the risk there is the lost opportunity to have learned a better way of doing things. Like so last week, Sher and I spent the whole week rebuilding our tools in preparation for GMS for GameMaker 2.3. So we're rebuilding our tools, and when we sat in to do it, I was like, I want to do this well, because for the next 5 years, the whole time we're doing Crashlands, right? So, which we assume presumably is 5 years we've learned from our future
according
self.
According to our future self.
Yeah.
So for the next 5 years, we're going to be using this tooling and adding more and more features to it to make it as easy as possible for us to develop this game. So the worse of a job I do now at the root of this thing, the worse and worse and worse every single subsequent thing gets. But the question is, how do I do a good job, right? Because a good job doesn't mean just like pay more attention and do things you already know how to do, but just like actually do them this time, right? If this is that what doing a good job means, right? Or does it mean learn more about what it means to do a good job, to discover things that you aren't already doing,
mm-hmm.
that make the thing significantly better, even if that time investment is high? So, because if we were to imagine me like putting that tool last week together the way that using my current knowledge at the time, even if I was still focusing on quality, it would have taken like a couple of days. Instead, it took a whole week, maybe even plus another day, actually, on a prior week, because now probably a third of my time was just spent learning stuff that I kind of knew about, but that I didn't actually know, and that I couldn't therefore use. And now, after having done all of this, I now have this whole new suite of tools at my disposal for being able to solve problems in ways that are just a lot more effective than what I was able to do previously. And so now that it took that 4 days or whatever of extra work, and I get to now decrease my work and make all my stuff better for the rest of time.
Yeah, I think you generally want to be actually sort of between these two states.
Right? Yeah, you want to ride the edge.
Because the thing is, like, I think if you're – say you're working on something that you've been doing – maybe you've been doing this thing for years, right? The reality is, especially if it's a remotely complex thing at all, then it should be the case that there's aspects of it that you still haven't really explored. So whether that's like, oh, yeah.
Okay, there are. If you don't know that there are, then you're just wrong about that.
Yeah. And so there's always more to kind of learn. And so I think you could be in your comfort zone sort of operating to get the bulk of something done. But I think if you're not constantly learning, then you're missing out on just like how fun – because that's actually what makes it all fun, to be honest. Because like just doing the work becomes rote after a bit.
Yeah, it's boring.
Yeah. And so I think always pushing to say like, okay, well, how can I – add some macros, or like, is there a way that someone's figured out how to do this even faster or with higher quality? But I do think this comes
really where you should be is in the space where you have you're outside your comfort zone where the risk is low.
Yes,
because the two scenarios we were given where it was a false dichotomy, right? Mm-hmm. Because the reality is, if you go to that space where you're uncomfortable, the likelihood is that actually that your risk of doing that is low. So the risk of failure, in the sense of like you having some trouble, if that's what failure means, is of course basically 100%, right? But the risk of like failure in a meaningful sense, meaning like now you're just fucked for some reason, I think is actually very, very low.
Yeah. This, we've talked about this before, but being able to differentiate between risk and danger is really important because people put them together all the time. So as long as you're in a category where things are risky, which just means, again, there's a chance you could fail, but does it matter? I mean,
what does failure mean?
Dangerous? Is it dangerous for you to fail, or is it – correct. Just another thing. It's just another lesson. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you just got to identify those things, and then you're good to go.
Yeah.
Right?
That's it.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We would like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.